Now here's a story of a young man who aspired to become a life insurance agent like his father without being hidden in his father's shadow. So he moved to another town and began working on his master's degree in insurance/finance. He called Tom Stanley for some tips on how to become an extraordinary sales professional.
I suggested networking. As I understand it, part of his master's program, and again, I'm not sure if it's an MS, MA, or MBA, but as I understand it, there is a thesis required. Now, he can do a thesis on mumbo jumbo, or he can do a truly enlightened thesis.
Such as?
Well, how about writing a thesis on the estate planning needs and attitudes of business leaders, where he, in fact, would be required to personally interview the top 100 CEOs of the privately held business in his current trade area?
Number one, would that be academically acceptable?
Well, I certainly think it would be. It could certainly be rigorous in terms of him developing some hypotheses, testing these hypotheses, using sophisticated statistical analyses and other types of things.
So if done correctly, okay, it can be academically acceptable.
No problem.
But how is he going to find out who the top 100 CEOs are in his area?
Well, again, I mean, he can certainly go around and do a sociometric design and ask people, you know, who are the biggies. But clearly in that town, I know firsthand that the business-to-business newspaper publishes the top 100 list, not only with the names of the companies, but the names of the executives and their addresses.
And how are they going to respond to helping somebody out on a thesis?
Well, what we're suggesting here is that he approach his major professor with this proposal. And hopefully, if his major professor is enlightened, he will seek the support of perhaps an insurance company, a major law firm that specializes in estate planning, perhaps a top insurance agency in the community that will sponsor this young man. In other words, they will pay for
all the survey work.
The survey work, exactly.
Okay.
And not only that, but they will give him some endorsement. And, of course, the university or college would also give him the endorsement. He will write letters to these people and tell them the purpose. Now, let me point out, this is the greatest way in the world to get a one-hour interview with the top 100 leading business people in the community. And not only that, but he would provide them with a summary of the report, telling them the state of intellect about estate planning, the needs that these people have and what they're currently doing and perhaps even what they need to do. Not only that, but we've had many instances where we have done this over the course of my 20 years as a professor where people were actually offered jobs during the course of the interview.
Hmm. And, of course, he would be sometimes providing good information to the CEO. Some of them may not know about estate planning and the ramifications.
Exactly. In fact, it's not surprising at all to find that 50% of these people don't have a will up to date, that they do not understand the estate tax law, that they do not understand the problems of second to die and how that relates to the insurance needs that people have, these types of things. And I would tell this person, and in fact I did, that there's nothing wrong with suggesting to these people that after I finish my master's degree, I may call upon you again to ask your advice about my career and where I should go, or if I can be so bold as even to suggest perhaps helping you down the road with an estate plan in concert with some networking people that I work with in the legal profession.
Nothing wrong with being upfront about the fact that you may have a return call later for sales purposes.
Absolutely, but you need to say that right up front, and you need to tell those people when you talk to them initially about that.
So the marketing implications of this whole plan, Tom, using a master's thesis to start a network, in a sense?
Exactly. And what's amazing to me is that people often spend years writing theses and dissertations that absolutely have no leverage capabilities in terms of developing a relationship with successful people. Here's a young man who has an opportunity to meet and interact and develop a network system with the leading business owners in his own community, and to do this without any help from home.
And, Tom, if I may add, once he does that, shouldn't he also provide business for them? In other words, he goes to the CEO who's the top timber supplier, and he says, oh, by the way, I heard that so-and-so just won the construction contract for 600 homes in this area. Shall I put you in touch?
That's exactly right, Mike. What he can do when he talks to these people is he can essentially develop two Rolodexes. One would be classified under product or service provided by the person that he interviews. The other would be the name of the person that he interviewed. As he progresses, he would ask these people, well, who's your accounting company? Are they good? What do you like about them? Who are your suppliers? Where do you get your office products? Who helps you with your computer work? Where do you get your paid service?
Why are you asking this? I thought the survey was about life insurance and estate planning.
Well, I think that once that's out of the way, there's nothing wrong with extending that and asking about these other questions. And then get back to them and say, again, what do you need? What do you buy? What do you sell? And let me do you a favor, Mr. Adams, while I'm interviewing you. If I talk to the 99 other successful people in this town and they tell me that they just won a contract to build the largest building within 100 miles of here, I might suggest to them that if they're interested in buying electric wire, that they see you. That is certainly appreciated. And in essence, what this young man of 24 years of age will have is that he will have a network of highly successful people if he wants to do that and if he's that ambitious. Certainly, he can share leads with different people. Interestingly enough, Mike, what you typically find is that the top 100 people often use the top 100 suppliers, and you can share this information with one another.
Recommendations for good marketing and sales professionals is that they take the time to donate their time and their skills to charitable organizations. Why?
Well, you'll find that many charities, in spite of their good intentions, are not proficient in marketing, especially marketing to the affluent. If you find someone who has an uncanny ability to sell the intangible, the insurance product, the investment product, the legal service, the accounting service, you'll find it's progressively more easy to sell charity.
Even though you're asking someone, you're not providing them a product, you're just asking somebody for a donation, it's easier?
It's how you ask and when you ask and who you ask.
When you ask brings up the fact that most charities have an annual drive of some sort. Many of them around the holiday season, of course, and sometimes at other times of the year, but a lot of times they have an annual drive. That's not the way to do it?
Well, don't you love the concept of the annual drive? Now, is that for the benefit of the people that you're targeting or for the benefit of the people that are asking for the money?
How so, Tom? I'm trying to understand what you're getting at here.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that many charitable organizations arbitrarily pick a time during the year when they're going to collect money. Let's say this, and I've had instances where this has taken place. I know of major charities that ask people for money during the worst time of the year, asking wealthy people to donate at the same time that their three children's tuition is due at the private school? Not sensible.
So how does the sales or marketing professional get into the picture for the charity?
Well, here's the thing. People who are skilled in marketing, they have certain skills. They may be top producers in the industries that we've discussed. Why can't they take the initiative of contacting people and saying, I have something to offer? We have different people in this organization. My role will be perhaps minister of marketing. Take a look in the newspaper. Almost daily, it'll say that Fred Jones appointed to head up a charity. Fred's scared. It's his responsibility and his reputation to gather funds. What kind of phone call would he like? Phone call from a financial consultant saying, Fred, is it a good time to invest? Fred said, no. It's a good time for a tranquilizer. Try this on for size. Fred, I am a financial consultant, but I'm calling today to congratulate you on being appointed the head of this charity, and I want to know if you'd be interested in having me help you gather funds. I have some expertise in this area, especially with affluent people.
Okay. Is there a hidden agenda here, Tom? Are you suggesting this so that they could do some further networking within the charity?
There's nothing wrong with doing that. Give and then receive. The fact is that you must give a great deal before you receive. And I see nothing wrong with that. I do not see it at all as an exploitation of the charity.
So you say work for a charity for the charity's purposes.
Exactly right.
And, you know, don't be afraid to use that somewhere down the line or have people approach you for your services.
Of course. In fact, one of the top sales professionals in this country once told me, and I quote, people see you at your best when you're doing things for charitable causes.
Be a little more specific, if you would, about Mr. Samuel. Can you give us an example of one of his episodes?
Well, he contacted me a few months ago, and he told me a case study that I thought was particularly interesting. He volunteered to be part of a charitable committee. And along those lines, he also purchased several seats at their rather expensive luncheon to gather funds. When the head of the charity asked Mr. Samuel a simple question, it's an interesting answer. Mr. Samuel, where would you like to sit? What was the answer? I'll sit anywhere, but do not place me at a table where any other people from the financial service industry are seated. It's very simple. So I sat him at a table with five millionaires. Mr. Samuel, five millionaires. Man on his left said to him, Mr. Samuel, what do you do? I'm in the investment business. Really? What can you do with seven? It's interesting, Mike. What can you do with seven?
7 million, did he mean?
7 million. Do you have a $7 million CD? And what did Mr. Samuel say?
No.
Of course. He said, well, that number comes to mind all the time. It's magic. And eventually, in fact, he did invest $7 million with Mr. Samuel. Why? Because there's a certain affinity, affiliation, and credibility. When people see other people helping charity, they say, these people are of a superior character and caliber. I want to be part of the group.
They want to help the community. I want to help the community, and that's
right.
I'm going to do business with them.
People see you at your best when you're helping with noble causes.
You have to bring something to the table. Mr. Samuel was bringing his marketing skills for the benefit of a good cause. He was recognized and rewarded for his efforts. But what if you're just starting out? You don't even know what your marketing skills are. You have no client base. What do you have to offer an attorney, a CPA, or a broker to induce them to share referrals with you?
It takes time. You must be patient. But in addition to that fact, you have to bring something to the table.
You have to bring something to the table. You just said it. What if you're just starting out, Tom?
Well, again, Mike, it's a very good question. Starting from ground zero today.
I mean, you don't know. Yeah, you don't know anybody. You don't have a network. You don't have a client base. You have
exactly. Let's say, for example, you visited an accountant or a lawyer. They say the same thing to you. Young man, young woman, you're 25 years old. You're wet behind the ears. You're 30 years old. You have no clients. That's true, sir. However, I have a list here of people that I will be visiting with. I have confirmed appointments with these people. When I do visit with them, I will ask them about how satisfied they currently are with their accountant, with their lawyer, and so forth. Would you mind if I mentioned you as a potential supplier? What this does, it puts you just in a different league. You can be 25 and wet behind the ears. You can be 25 and have no clients. But if you walk into a seasoned professional and say, I know how to play the game. I'm street smart. I want to be your apostle. I want to enhance your revenue. That's my deal. That's how I'm succeeding. They'll pick you over 100 other people, I'll guarantee you.
I can understand how that would be appealing, even if somebody, like you say, wet behind the ears, mm-hmm. approaches a seasoned professional. How does the person wet behind the ears choose which seasoned professionals he's going to be, selling for, essentially?
Well, it's a good point. There's no hard and fast rules. Now, there are a lot of business-to-business newspapers in different cities that will list the top 20, the top 50, the top 100 independent accounting firms. But you can start with the Yellow Pages. The key ingredient here is to walk in and talk to these people, call these people, make an appointment with them, and find out if they're street smart. In other words, are they sensitive to this whole concept of networking? If you find that these people are dull normals, you're essentially going to go nowhere with these people. And as I pointed out earlier, it's very, very important if you, in fact, have one accountant that you patronize in terms of doing your accounting, pick the one that says, I'm a networker, I'm a player, I know how to play the game, and we do reward people that help us network. In fact, Mike, I mentioned David Carisio, who, in fact, would go to the water department every morning, and he would look at the records and find out who moved into Boca Raton, Florida, who lived in a big house, who bought a business, and so forth and so on. And then he would visit these people. Now, the reason that he was so very successful is when he did identify someone that was wealthy moving into the community and did call them, he had a very important message. It was the network message. It wasn't only the water department and getting their names. What did he say to these people?
Let me guess, Tom. What do you need?
What do you need exactly? In other words, what's the message? Do you need a financial consultant? That's not the message. Dull, dull, dull. Me, me, me. No. What do you need? Do you need an accountant since you've moved here from Chicago? Do you need a lawyer since you've moved here from Fresno, California? Do you need a landscape architect since your lawn is a mess? Do you need a home builder? Do you have a hole in your roof? What do you need? Now, the beautiful thing about the Carisio system, and here's a guy starting from ground zero. You talked about, where do you start? What would he do? He would call surgeons. He would call accountants. He would call lawyers. He would call roofers. What would he say? Would you find it presumptuous if I mentioned your name to the millionaires that are moving into Boca Raton and all the business owners that are opening businesses here? Would you find it presumptuous? They don't find it presumptuous. They want to know where this guy's been hiding for the last 20 years. He's the first person to ever come to them and say, look, first I'm going to do a favor for you, and maybe you'll do a favor for me. That's essentially why it works so well. Because what it tells people is that this person is extraordinary. He's an apostle. He's a networker. He's out there selling for me before I buy a product for him.
Let me play the devil's advocate role one more time, Tom, especially for some of those who might be, say, doubting Thomas's out there. How did he pick which surgeon to call, which lawyer, which builder, whatever, to say that he was going to do the selling for them?
Well, it's interesting. Let me tell you in a broad sense how that can be done. You can essentially contact surgeons and accountants and ask them who they think is the cream of the crop within the industry. It's a little sociometric design that they do in sociology. And what you'll find is that eventually you'll talk to 50 surgeons. They'll point to two or three. You can call those people up if you'd like. And not only that, you say put them on a preferred list because they've been endorsed by their colleagues. Same with accountants. It's not just saying, I will provide you with the name of an accountant who may be a dull normal. You should do your homework and you should find out who the people are who are best. But most importantly, find out who the specialists are. In other words, who's the best accountant to deal with people that really understand the needs of surgeons moving into town?
Who's the best tax lawyer who understands the changes in the laws as they occur?
That's right. Who is the best attorney to deal with estate planning for someone just moving into the community that needs to do that because they're going to have their will move from Illinois to Florida?
And will he know the best life insurance agent that might help out in this estate planning situation?
Exactly. But again, Mike, and most importantly, it just tells people that you're talking to that you're a highly intelligent person because you understand their fundamental need. And their fundamental need is more business, revenue enhancement, and on the other side, I need to get new suppliers. Now, again, we go back to the concept that I was mentioning before. Let's say a construction contractor moves his entire business from the slow-moving Midwest to red-hot, let's say, Dade County, Florida. He may need 360 suppliers. And who shows up within 24 hours of this perceived need? David Curicio, with a list of not only commercial suppliers, but personal suppliers. You can't help but like people like that. And he started from absolute ground zero. No previous clients, walked in the door and took off and was the number one producing broker in that major branch within 1 year.
The occupations of the successful networkers you've already heard about. Financial consultant, construction equipment supplier, dentist, securities broker, stockbroker, life underwriter. Which of these occupational groups exerts the most influence with affluent business owners and professionals? Can you hazard a guess? Answer, none of the above. 200 accountants essentially influence perhaps as many as 10,000 wealthy people in their choice of everything from A to Z. That's the way the world works. Tom Stanley's research has consistently shown that as a generic group, accountants are the single most influential opinion leaders for wealthy business owners and professionals in this country. And that's why most of the discussions you're about to hear revolve around CPAs. Our first case study along these lines is the story of Mr. Todd.
All right, Tom, how did Mr. Todd, an extraordinary sales professional, identify the affluent affinity groups that were located within his trade area?
Well, Mr. Todd's a financial consultant with extraordinary intellect for finding where high concentrations of wealth may be. He did three things using three sources. First, he looked at GALE's Directory of Regional, State, and Local Associations, typically available at your local library. Also, he contacted his local Chamber of Commerce. And third, and perhaps most effectively and most economically, he looked in the yellow pages under the heading of associations. Isn't it amazing how many people spend a fortune looking for high concentrations of wealth and buying lists, when in fact the lists of high concentrated affinity groups are often available for free?
Right in the yellow pages. But how did he use this information from Gale's directory of regional, state, and local associations, the Chamber of Commerce information, and the yellow pages association section?
Well, there's no prediction that's perfect in terms of understanding or predicting essentially who has money and who doesn't in terms of these affinity groups. What he did is he looked under this Gale's directory of regional, state, and local associations for his particular state and his particular region, his particular locale, and he just listed all the affinity groups and then contacted these people. He did the same thing with the Chamber of Commerce. He called the local Chamber of Commerce and asked for a list of the affinity groups that were within his three-county area, and they sent it to him. And he looked in the yellow pages under the same heading of associations. Then he called these people and typically spoke to either the head of the trade association, the head of the affinity group, or their assistant. And what he would say to them very simply is, I am a financial consultant. I, in fact, provide financial advice, financial wisdom, investment products and services to people who are business owners, professionals, and other people who are typically successful. In order to do a better job serving the people that are members of your affinity group, it's important for me to stay current. I wonder if you could send me some back issues of your newsletters and or trade journals.
Well, did they comply? Did they send him the newsletters or trade journals?
Over 90% of the people agreed to send and did in fact send the trade journals and newsletters to Mr. Todd. Interestingly enough, they did not charge him for this. They did honor his request.
Hmm. And what did he do with the information? I imagine some of these journals are probably very technical, but others might have different types of information. What did he do first?
Well, that's true. When he got these different periodicals, he did what we call the Mr. Todd sort. In other words, two categories. Many trade journals, many newsletters are highly technical. They talk product, they talk product, they talk product, and service, service, service. They talk equations, they talk chemical composition. These are not what we're looking for. About half of them, however, are periodicals that really discuss the achievements and the success of people that are members of the affinity group. Businesses for sale, promotions, windfall dollars coming in, patents approved, patents sold, royalties in, royalties out. That's what Todd focused on.
In other words, people who are, as you say, euphoric, Tom.
Absolutely euphoric. In fact, it's very interesting. I think Mr. Todd told me the first little newsletter he did get, which is about an 8-page, not very pretty in terms of its graphics, but right on the front cover, there was a picture of a man who was, in fact, selling his gas station that he had for 25 years for $350,000. Mr. Todd called the guy, and guess what?
What does he say to these people? I mean, how does he approach them?
Well, that's interesting. First thing, the man said, nobody else called. That's the kicker. $350,000 cash for the gas station and the property, nobody else called. So what Mr. Todd said is, Mr. Smith, I saw you in gas station news. I just wanted to call and ask if you have any idea about how you're going to spend your time after you retire. Great way to deal with the issue, because Mr. Todd has helped other people in terms of this transition period of selling a business, and they discussed these things. Mr. Todd went on. I read about you. It's very interesting. You've been in business for such a long time, so forth and so on. Many of my current clients at one time owned a business and sold a business. They found it wasn't that easy to sell a business. You may want to contact some of these people and talk to them about some of the symptoms of withdrawal that you might have when, in fact, you go cold turkey. The man was receptive to this. I understand he opened an account with Mr. Todd. But this is typical of what we're talking about. And the beauty of prospecting using these little newsletters and localized trade journals is the fact that there's no directory of localized trade journals and newsletters. Now, there are many directories that will help you with the big ones and the national and the regionals, but this is something that's geographically specific and typically
also
nobody
joining
else
some
does.
Of these trade associations. That may strike our listeners as a little bit odd, Tom, and you're a financial consultant. I mean, you should belong to Financial Consultants Association, but why join a gas station owners association or whatever?
Well, it's interesting. You know, in another instance, in fact, a young woman that worked for the same company that Todd is employed by recently walked in to a meeting of public relations executives, people that typically own their own public relations firms, and they said the same thing to her. What are you doing here? This is a meeting for public relations people. And she said, I am a supplier to this industry. Several of my most important clients are part of this affinity group, and it's important for me to be here to learn about what's going on in this industry. You know what the man said to her? Sit down. It's very simple. In other words, most people define their business as only their product-specific business. Mr. Todd says, very simply, that I am a supplier to affluent business owners, and I must be part of their affinity group, and that's what he does. Now, some of these affinity groups, the cost of joining is prohibitively expensive. However, others, it's free or next to free in terms of joining. It may be $30 or $35 to become an associate member of these affinity groups. His choice of joining affinity groups was based on whether or not he had a current client that he could help and he understood the business, but also whether or not the particular affinity group did have a monthly newsletter which would be available to him that will discuss those people that are being successful, those people that are selling businesses and so forth and so on. And also, if there was some potential that he could be put on a committee where he would interact with many of the members to be a person that would be considered as a helper, a supporter, an apostle. And I know in other cases this has happened. I've seen people join for $30 or $40. They put them on an important committee like the investment committee that invests funds of the union or invests funds of the trade association. And you're sitting right in the middle of these people, and you're the only person in town that's helping these people in terms of that product-specific area.
So has he formed kind of a network by joining different trade associations and keeping track of different trade associations, Todd?
Yes, he has. In fact, it goes even beyond that, and I think this is where the true intellect of Mr. Todd pops up. Not only is he becoming an apostle and a network member for selected affinity groups by joining the membership, attending their meetings, reading their trade journals, but he's also aligned himself with CPAs in the three-county area that's part of his trade association. He's also aligned himself with a very important group, people that we define as business brokers, those people who help medium and small business owners sell businesses, and also they find buyers and so forth and so on.
Why? Why include CPAs, business brokers, and members of, as you said, selected affinity groups? Why lump all these people together, so to speak?
Well, again, our research, and we pointed this out earlier, shows very clearly that overall the CPA is the single most important referral that you can get if you're trying to sell people that are their clients. And typically, the small and medium-sized affluent business owner will go to the accountant and say, I've had windfall profit this year. What do I do with the money? Who's going to help me invest? What do you recommend in terms of financial consultant, financial planner, life insurance agent, attorney, whatever it may be? The CPA is typically a very, very important part of that referral system.
Networking workshops are another alternative to the sometimes frightening prospect of starting from ground zero on your own.
Ms. Johnson, originally, I believe, was a financial planner and, again, developed this concept of networking her own, and now she provides it on a commercial basis to those people that want to participate. Let's say, for example, you are a financial consultant and you would like to prospect people who are orthopedic surgeons or advertising agencies, or people that own advertising agencies, I should say. What she would do is she would look for other types of sales professionals, professionals in general, business owners, who would in fact like to serve that same group or already have clients in that business. So she would put together, in this latest incidence, in fact, where I was looking at this thing, there were 21 different people from 21 different industries that are on a networking system. I believe that Jeannie put these people together, and she got the first four in the door and got them talking to one another. Then each one of those people had to get two other people and recruit them, and eventually they had 21 people. They meet once a week at a very nice breakfast early in the morning and essentially provide leads to other people. They would say that this person is a good prospect for this. And it's a very interesting concept, because what you're doing, let's say I'm a financial consultant. I sit at a table with 20 people who are actually working for me, and I'm working for them. So I'm not here just to sell my product. I'm helping these other people.
Let's back up a little bit, Tom. What types of professionals does Jeannie Johnson typically put into a network?
Well, it may be people from advertising, public relations, telephone communication, the training industry, direct marketing, the investment area, insurance, accounting, fundraising.
Why? These are all very different from each other. Why? What do they have in common?
Well, it has what we call the concept of complementary versus substitutable products and services. These people are all complementary, meaning that one particular prospect may want to use all these different types of products and services or have some possibility of doing that.
At some day and time. Not all at once, of course. But
exactly. So when you walk in the door to talk to someone, a prospect, or you have been referred to by someone in the network, what you're saying is, I represent 21 industries. What do you need? And by the way, if we don't have somebody, we'll go out and get them. And that's the way the world works. But you will find that something like this works extremely well because one thing that people need in business is revenue enhancement and good source of good suppliers. So what Jeannie instructs her members to do is to always ask clients, prospects, potential members of the network, what do you buy? What do you sell? How can we help you?
Tom, help me out here. I'm a little bit confused. I can understand how a network of 21 different types of complementary professionals can be helping each other. Obviously, each one is selling for all the others, so you actually have 21 people selling for you as well as yourself. And it works in a tit-for-tat way. But I'm a little confused because we started this conversation by talking about someone who wants to target a specific affinity group, like you might want orthopedic surgeons or you might want advertising executives. So how does that fit in with joining a network that represents 21 different affinity groups rather than just one affinity group? You see what I'm...
Yes, I understand that. No, in terms of orthopedic surgeons, for example, recently I became aware of a top-producing financial consultant that originally was the top sales professional providing orthopedic equipment to orthopedic surgeons. He left that industry and became a financial consultant. So who did he focus on? Orthopedic surgeons.
He already knew them.
Exactly. So, for example, let's say a fundraiser targets orthopedic surgeons. He might look at other parts of the medical profession as well, but why would he want to sit at the table with this financial consultant that specializes with orthopedic surgeons? Obviously, there's some referral system here. He can call these people and say, by the way, the person that provides you all that great financial wisdom is one of my colleagues in the network, and I'd like to come over and talk to you about perhaps endorsing our charity. On the other hand, it may be that that person that's a fundraiser has been very successful in relating to people, for example, in the automobile industry. And perhaps the financial consultant would like to target people that are people that own automobile dealerships. And it's tit for tat, as you say. That's what would happen. That's a simplified approach, but it does work.
Oh, so all 21 people essentially trade parts of their own networks that they've already developed.
Exactly. In fact, the fundraiser may get the financial consultant to sit on several charity boards and meet lots of wealthy people. But the key here is it takes time. You must be patient. But in addition to that fact, you have to bring something to the table. And as I understand it, what the people do is that they share leads, they share referrals, and they do it in a very aggressive manner because they want to win the award of the week, which is more referrals than anybody else.
Endorsements
spread infinitely more rapidly within the context of an affinity group than they do from people that are targeting all 22,000 industries in America simultaneously.
So in choosing a network, look at your own client base first. See if you got one of those who has a lot of ones. And if you got a two or three somewhere, maybe look at that one first.
Mm-hmm.
What about your own interests and hobbies and things like that? Does it ever relate to networking?
Absolutely. I've met many people that, for example, are involved with ecological issues that have capitalized on this very, very well. One character that I met, extraordinary sales professional, who deeply believes in the issues of enhancing the environment and so forth. He started to prospect environmental engineers. With what? With an ecologically sensitive mutual fund. A fund of the equities of companies that are on the top 20 list of people and companies that are most sensitive to the ecology. And of course, it also helped to have his picture taken while he was on the picket line picketing a major nuclear plant to be shut down.
to show sympathy with the same causes that the
Absolutely.
People he's trying to.
But make no mistake about it, it's not a gimmick. It's not a show.
He really is concerned
he
about the
really
environment.
And genuinely is concerned. There's nothing worse than someone that pretends to be concerned about the issues of an affinity group just to exploit it in terms of money. They won't be happy, and their constituents won't be happy, and eventually they, in fact, will be revealed.
Age of 32, Dan Speak has been the top-producing life insurance agent of his company for the past 8 years. He nets $1,000 a day and has received much favorable publicity. As you can imagine, he is frequently the target of other sales professionals. But, says Tom Stanley, 99% of those unannounced, uninvited cold callers are antagonists to and not apostles for Dan Speak. 99%. That leaves 1%.
He was in his office one day, and a young character showed up, unannounced, just walked in. First characteristic of great salespeople is courage. And said, Dan, I've heard a great deal about you. You're a legend. I've read the press, read your clippings, read about you in the book. Of course, acknowledgement of achievement is also very important for high achievers, which he did. So he praised Dan. He said, Dan, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to speak to 200 certified public accountants that run their own accounting businesses that serve the needs of wealthy business owners. And there's a pause. Now, Dan was stunned by this because these are precisely the people he's trying to see, precisely the types of people that his competitors are trying to see, and very often these people will not see people that are providing life insurance products. And here's Dan getting an offer to speak to these people. Dan's reply, as you might appreciate, was immediately, of course. And then Dan said to this character, how long have you been a certified public accountant? And this character, we'll call him Mr. Smythe, said, I'm not a certified public accountant. I'm a stockbroker. Dan says to Mr. Smythe, then what in heavens are you doing asking me to speak on behalf of accountants if you're a stockbroker? Now, this clever young man said, one of the best ways to network with high concentrations of wealthy people, and even more importantly, patronage opinion leaders, accountants by far, as a group, are the most influential in affecting the patronage habits of wealthy business owners that are their clients in terms of choice of stockbroker, attorney, gardener, and life underwriter. So what the young stockbroker is doing is he's becoming an apostle to a group of accountants. He's providing them speakers, and Dan is one of those speakers. Now, how did Dan respond to this? This is what he said. He said, dozens of people in the last couple of months have been in here asking for my business. It really aggravates me. No one has ever focused on my need for ego enhancement, revenue enhancement, acknowledgement and empathy for my problems and everything else. And this is what he said to him. He said, young man, I'm sure I'm going to get some business out of this because there'll be 200 people there. If I get one dime, you can invest it anywhere
you
want.
You have taken to heart the message that CPAs are probably the most influential advisors to the affluent. The final case history, networker case history, is a slam dunk reinforcement of that assessment because the ace of aces in networking, according to Tom Stanley, is, are you ready? A CPA.
His name is Arthur Gifford. He's a senior partner of a highly successful privately held accounting firm. There are several senior partners. He and two other colleagues founded the business 11 years ago. Initially, the firm had only three CPAs. Today, it employs 34, along with nearly 20 other types of professionals and support staff. I understand the firm has over 800 clients, plus 50 major corporate audit types, and 300-plus tax consulting projects. Firm continues to grow. The bulk of Mr. Gifford's clients are either owners of highly successful small and medium-sized businesses or high-performance self-employed professionals.
Well, since you call him the ace of aces in terms of networking, how did he attract all this business?
You know, it's really interesting, Mike, about this. He has never knocked on a door. He has never made a call. All of this business has been part of his influence, or what we call referral network.
Well, who are the members of this influence or referral network?
Well, there are many. It might take me a half hour to go through all of that, but they're opinion leaders, including several important attorneys who, in fact, specialize in helping successful business owners and professionals with their needs, various types of loan officers, several physicians, business brokers, security brokers, and insurance agents. That's just to mention a few, but there are a wide variety of them. One of the segments in terms of his influence network is of particular interest. It includes auto dealers.
Auto dealers. Now, you have to wonder. He can't buy a car from every auto dealer, so he can't capture them that way as parts of his referral network. How did he go about it?
Many of Mr. Gifford's high-income generating clients hate to shop for automobiles. Yes, I repeat, hate to shop even for luxury automobiles. They will tell you that they do not have the time to shop around, and also they despise the negotiating process associated with purchasing an automobile.
But everybody needs a car sometime in their life. How do they go about buying a car if they hate to shop?
Well, the pro forma for many truly high-income, high-net-worth people is very simple. These high-income, high-net-worth people walk into a dealer and walk out with an automobile because they never shop around, never compare prices, never do their homework. They typically pay top dollar for their purchase, or they sign a leasing deal that was no bargain.
So they do have some problems buying cars. Then what does Mr. Gifford do to solve the problem for his clients?
He acts as their apostle or advocate. He keeps a list of selected dealers, sales managers, and top sales professionals that market luxury automobiles.
Ah, I heard another term there, Tom. Selected dealers. What do you mean by that?
Mr. Gifford has a list of marketers of luxury automobiles that will give significant discounts to his clients. He will either give a copy of this list to a client that seeks his help in such matters, or he will actually negotiate the purchase or lease himself. In other words, he will do the shopping and the haggling over price on behalf of the client. Upon request, he will even include the client in a negotiation via a three-way conference call, but most prefer he cut the deal by himself.
But are all these dealers his clients as well, Tom?
No, only a small number on the list are his clients. But since he often sends them business, they often reciprocate by making referrals on his behalf. And Mr. Gifford goes out of his way to find the best and most competitive suppliers that he may refer his clients to.
So he's actually finding the best dealers that are going to give his clients a pretty good discount, a good deal. This seems to be going beyond the basic accounting service quite a ways, Tom, to what one might call maybe a supplier screening service?
Correct again, Mike. But what do you think most self-employed professionals and business owners really want from Mr. Gifford?
They want more revenue, more clients.
And that's exactly what Mr. Gifford does, and that's exactly why we consider him to be the ace of aces in networking.
Other than referrals to luxury auto dealers, what other types of suppliers are part of Mr. Gifford's influence network?
I asked him the same question. Then he opened the drawer of his credenza. It's a large credenza and a large drawer. Good thing, because it contained 80 stacks of business cards.
Not 80 business cards, 80 stacks?
80 stacks of business cards. All were from the network members, people who Mr. Gifford, in his estimation, qualified to supply his clients with products and or services. Some members are buyers of products and services, others
an example of how
are
Mr.
both
Gifford
buyers
might help
and
a client.
Sellers. When I recently interviewed him, I guess the day before, something very interesting happened. A young, extraordinary sales professional called upon him and suggested that he was in the process of looking for new representation in terms of an accounting firm. This young man is only 27 years of age. Last year, he earned approximately $200,000 a year. He essentially sells financing packages for medical equipment dealers. So why should he deal with Mr. Gifford? Well, first of all, Mr. Gifford looked over his accounting records over the last 3 years and strongly suggested that the young man did not take advantage of all the options available to him in terms of write-offs. But in addition to that fact, he took time to ask this young man the basic and fundamental questions of networking. What do you sell? What do you buy? And he explained to this young man that if, in fact, he became a client, he would be able to become part of his network system. That, in fact, he would make calls on behalf of the young man to see if he could provide him with new markets.
Now, what would Mr. Gifford be offering him in terms of a core service? He's offering them the network, but what would be the start of the relationship?
The start of the relationship was very simple. He guaranteed him that he would save him more money than the fee that he would charge him in terms of tax reduction.
Okay, so right there he offers a good core service, but then he also adds the network to it. Why would Mr. Gifford be wanting to help out this young man in terms of networking?
Because a significant number of Mr. Gifford's clients are potential users of this young man's service. They are surgeons and physicians of other types. In fact, Mr. Gifford, while he was interviewing this prospective client, made a telephone call to a person who has a highly successful business selling medical equipment. He put these two together, and because of that fact, this young man ultimately this year enhanced his own revenue by $30,000.
Okay, Tom, this young man has been helped by Mr. Gifford, this young man who sells financing packages for medical equipment. How does he in turn help Mr. Gifford?
Well, he comes into contact with hundreds of physicians each year. He takes time to discuss their needs beyond equipment. From time to time, they point out that they suffer from lack of good service in terms of their accounting.
So then he refers to Mr. Gifford, of course.
Absolutely. And that's part of the network. In fact, Mr. Gifford is not shy about it at all. He tells people about his expectations. He'll help them, and he hopes that they, in fact, will reciprocate.
What other types of services does Mr. Gifford offer in terms of through his network?
Well, one of the most important, especially for business owners, as you might imagine, Mike, beyond what we would call revenue enhancement, is what we would call credit. Mr. Gifford goes out of his way to meet various types of loan officers because they provide an important service to his clients. He has 9 categories of loan officers in his stacks. Now, what you typically find is that there is some uncertainty associated with getting credit at a bank. What Mr. Gifford does is he provides a significant number of referrals from his network to the bank. In return, he expects that when he endorses one of his network members in terms of qualification for loan, that the loan will be approved.
Of course, if he is their accountant, he should know how sound financially some people are.
And that's basically the message. What he is saying to the bank officer is that John Smith, my client, for example, should be given a loan, not based on his current financial record, but on my estimation of how well he and his business will be doing in the future. It's very important for bankers, in this case, lending officers, to be responsive to Mr. Gifford, to be sensitive to his endorsements, because if they do not heed his advice, he might not send them any more business.
For people who aren't like Mr. Gifford, aren't CPAs or accountants.
Let's say you're a life insurance agent. You make an appointment, 10 a.m., to visit the owner of an automobile dealership. You can come in with 2 messages. Your basic message, which hasn't been working lately, or the message that Mr. Gifford shows up with. Can you imagine the impact when Mr. Gifford calls a luxury car dealer, the owner of a luxury car dealer, and says, we have 800 clients. Many of them drive luxury cars. We have a high number of people who are surgeons. They buy very expensive luxury cars. I hope you won't find it presumptuous, but several of them asked me to act as their representative to purchase cars for them. I wonder if you have this model, this model, this model in stock, how much you'll sell it for, when it can be delivered. You don't find it presumptuous, do you? I'm sure that your accountant does this for you all the time. Now, there's going to be a long pause on the phone because this man might faint.
Mm-hmm. He's saying, what, you mean you're an accountant and you're calling me to buy my cars? I don't understand what's going on here.
It's just part of the total service package. So the next time you visit people that own small or medium-sized businesses, you have to have more than the core product in mind, more than the core product in your pocket. You must be able to talk about their needs, to let them understand that you have access to other people that might potentially be buyers or suppliers to them and enhance their revenue and their bottom line.
Tom, looking at the list of the categories of the networks of Mr. Gifford, it's really an amazingly long list. I'd just like to give a few of them here. Payroll service, security systems, business forms, roofing contractors, 9 categories of physicians and surgeons, real estate agents and brokers, printers, car dealers, contractors, photographers, computer dealers, lawn care, and landscaping organizations, and it goes on and on. I'm sure you can give dozens of stories of how he is networking this person to that person to that person, etc. and so forth. What are some of the lessons to be learned by what he does?
Well, after a long and lengthy discussion with Mr. Gifford and writing much of this material up, we've come up with 10 rules for capitalizing upon Mr. Gifford's system. We call them the Arthur 80 system for networking. Number one, always, always, always think about your own patronage habits. Patronize a CPA, a lawyer, a doctor, suppliers in general that already have a network that you can benefit from. In other words, pick a CPA and other suppliers that essentially have the clients that you wish to serve. Isn't it extraordinary that there are thousands of people in the city that you're sitting in right now that can help you with your accounting? What was your choice? Because Uncle Harry said to go see this fellow? Because he's down the street, he's in the yellow pages? It's ridiculous. Interview a CPA like you were interviewing for a job for life. Ask these people if they're street smart. Do they have a network that you can benefit from? If, in fact, for some reason, you decide that you would like to have a large number of construction contractors as clients, find a CPA that has a lot of construction contractors as clients.
In other words, you'll be my CPA if, on occasion, you might refer me to some of your contracting clients.
You see, Mike, you're ahead of me already. That's number two. It's not enough just for a CPA to have clients that you want. It's not enough just to say that they have a network. You have to determine right up front before you sign up for their service that you will join and benefit from the network. Remember, many people have networks, but they will not share them with people. Ask for the names of current clients of the accounting firm that you deal with, and maybe some others. Ask these people if, in fact, they have been given referrals and they have been given access to the network. Talk is cheap. Action is everything in this business.
Why would a CPA give you the names of current clients?
Because that's the name of the game. If, in fact, he's willing to take your money and take you on as a client, then he should be willing to share his reputation and his clients with you.
Getting back to the 10 rules of the game here, what's number three, Tom?
Be willing and communicate your willingness to reciprocate regarding referrals. Even at ground zero, the Abe Lincoln story does work. What that means is that from the very first day you're on the job selling, you can approach accountants and say, it is my objective in life to meet hundreds, perhaps thousands, of successful business owners and professionals. And I'd like to be able to mention that I know someone with the skills that you suggest that you have that can help these people with their problems. Have a long-run view. Be patient. It takes considerable amount of time to perfect your networking skills and system. Be prepared and don't be discouraged when you find that you receive only one referral for every 5 that you give. It's give, give, give before you ever receive.
And what's a good estimate, Tom, of the amount of time it would take to, say, establish your own network and you were doing it from ground zero?
From ground zero, it is not unusual to take at least a full year to develop a network where you start to see some major returns.
I felt I could starve in the meantime.
You won't starve, but it's not easy. But it's like anything else. If you really want to succeed, like many of the people that we've interviewed, you'll find that you will be frustrated, and you may, in fact, be poor for the first couple of years. But down the road, inevitably, if you give and you plant the seeds today, they will sprout.
Rule number 5.
Spend more time with the members of your influence network than you spend with your colleagues and your competitors. Most people that fail in sailing are people that would rather associate with their own colleagues and their own competitors to go to meetings with these people. Join your clients' affinity groups. Network with these people. Read their literature.
Instead of hanging around with salesmen, hang around with the people who should be your clients.
Exactly. What's interesting to me is if you take a look at the last 100 lunches that you went to, tell me what percentage were spent with people that were potential members of the influence network. If, in fact, you're an Arthur Gifford type, 80% are network members, 20% are all others. Typically, it's the other way around. Mediocre sales professionals typically spend 80% of their luncheon time with competitors, colleagues, and others, and 20% of their time with potential clients and or network members.
Rule number 6.
Be willing and be able to recruit business for members of your influence network. And when you do this, very, very important, document your referrals via a letter. Anytime you make a referral, put it in writing, send copies. For example, very simply, suggest, enjoyed meeting with you today. Sorry we couldn't get together on that insurance deal. However, there's someone that I think that you want to meet who probably would be delighted to have you as a client. Mr. Arthur Gifford, Certified Public Accountant. CC to Mr. Gifford, Art, I'm out here, and sometimes when you're not, I'll be your eyes and I'll be your ears.
You document it, you remind both the person that you're making the referral to and the person you referred to that this was done.
You see, Mike, you're jumping ahead again and you're thinking, it's great. Number 7, keep in contact with important members of the network. Provide them with intelligence concerning prospects, endorse them, do your PR for them, do your homework for them, be their intelligence system.
Number 8.
Entertain. What does that mean? Think of it this way. In talking to all these great networkers, we talk about the concept of what we could call social time, entertainment time. Many people that are not successful in selling find that their entertainment is almost purely in the realm of entertaining people that are not members of their network. If you don't play golf, you may want to learn. If you cannot interact with these people at a social level, perhaps you should do something else. Try another profession. Perhaps get into teaching.
Number 9.
Work with several CPAs. Help them in terms of revenue enhancement. You will find that the certified public accountants in the United States, as a general rule, are the single most important opinion leaders in terms of the patronage habits of successful business owners and affluent professionals.
And last but not least, number 10.
Never make a referral for profit only. Never refer a client or any other network member to those who cannot do the job. To do so would be a breach of integrity and to the foundation stones with which your affluent network is composed of.
Deal with people honestly and refer them to the best that you know to refer them to.
And that's why it's so very, very important, Mike, to only include the ace of aces from different disciplines in your network. Proven people, people of integrity. It's very easy in a short run to recruit people that perhaps will, in the short run, will give you business, but in the long run could be your downfall.
Foundation stones to networking with millionaires and their advisors. According to Tom Stanley, there are 5 foundation stones.
First, most affluent people are members of one or more affinity groups. Second, information about the quality and integrity of suppliers, including referrals and endorsements, diffuses much more rapidly among members of the same group. Third, the affluent market segment is growing 7 times faster than the household population in this country. Fourth, high-performance networkers gain endorsements for reasons that go beyond the basic product or service that they offer. And 5, high-caliber networkers focus their efforts.
Okay, Tom, let's go back and explain each a little bit. First, most affluent people are members of one or more affinity groups. Groups such as what?
Trade associations, professional societies, retiree, senior, mature citizens groups, ecologically defined associations, political groups, alumni associations, and so forth.
Might they be things like the Sierra Club or Physicians for Social Responsibility, those kinds of things?
Or the Scrap Metal Dealers of America.
Aha. Uh-huh. So we're thinking in a whole different vein here, not just the big groups that everybody might hear about, but some other trade associations then, too.
Well, I've always said that trade associations and professional societies and some of these other groups typically contain some of the highest concentrations of wealthy prospects.
Now, the second foundation stone, Tom, information about the quality and integrity of suppliers, including referrals and endorsements, diffuses much more rapidly among members of the same group. You seem to be hinting here that good news travels a whole lot faster within a group rather than between groups.
That's right. The speed of intra-group word-of-mouth recommendations is many times faster than inter-group communications. In English, what that means very simply is that if you do a good job for a member, an important or influential member of an affinity group, they're much more likely to spread that information among other members, and it will take place much more rapidly.
Three, the affluent market segment is growing seven times faster than the household population in this country. That's a surprise, Tom, given the current economic conditions in this country. After all, we've been in a recession for a couple of years now.
Well, some people like recessions, and some people thrive in recessions. You know, it's interesting to me, especially, Mike, on the other side of the equation, some of the best salespeople in this country like recessions, because what it does is it keeps a lot of people out of their industry, the sales industry, those that don't have the tenacity to go out and sell. But let me say this, dollar for dollar, the most productive way to penetrate the affluent market is to network with its members, their advisors, and key members of their important affinity groups. In spite of this fact, more than 90% of the sales and marketing professionals that we've interviewed who target the affluent do not network. Why? Most of these people do not know how to network. Others are too impatient to play this role.
High-performance networkers, this is four, the fourth foundation stone, high-performance networkers gain endorsements for reasons that go beyond the basic product or service that they offer.
That's right, Mike. They do extraordinary things, and these eight extraordinary things that they do beyond their basic core product or service is really the purpose of this tape album and the book that I recently produced.
High-caliber networkers focus their efforts. This seems like it could be very, very important.
Well, they first target those that will give them the greatest return. In other words, if you're saying to yourself, who should I target next? The next target that you approach should be the single most important one that you can find. This is directly analogous to this theorem in a military sense. Sergeant Carlos Hathcock of the Marine Corps was our nation's top marksman in Vietnam. Early one morning on patrol, he discovered 150 NVAs marching in an open valley. Who was the target of his first shot? The leader of the group, of course. This action had an immediate and profound psychological effect on the other NVA soldiers. During the three-day battle, Sergeant Hathcock and his companion, Corporal Burke, were able to eliminate most of the other members of this affinity group. In fact, Mike, if you want to read about this, I suggest you read Charles Henderson's Marine Sniper. In paperback form, it's only about $6. He's quite a targeted person.
Let me see if I can make a slight guess here, Tom, about how this might apply to networking. You said he targeted, of course, the head of the NVAs. That seems to me, well, if we're going to look at trade associations, then maybe the first person we ought to be friends with and do something for, other than the core product, might be the head of the trade association.
Of course, Mike, and that's what I'm suggesting. In other words, why should you prospect 1,000 people in the next year when you can prospect 10 or 20 or 30 heads of trade associations that if, in fact, you gain their endorsement, you'll be able to quite easily penetrate the rest of this particular market? Even more interestingly, many people already have the head of trade associations as clients and customers. Interestingly, but they never asked. A young fellow recently called me from the state of Texas. Asked me the same question. How do I target the affluent? We started talking about the heads of trade associations. He called me back a week later. One of his best clients is the president of a trade association that represents 9,000 business owners. He never knew that until he asked him. And because he asked him, he was invited to speak at their meeting. And because of that fact, he was a speaker, they gave him a free booth where he got much business in that 3.5-day period.
Five foundation stones of networking with millionaires and their advisors, let's explore the eight guiding principles to become an expert networker. Eight different techniques or faces that different expert networkers employ. We'll discuss each one in detail in a few minutes, but now let's briefly run down the eight faces. Face one is the purchasing agent.
Well, let's assume for a moment that I'm a successful sales professional. Or I'm considered to be a great marketing professional or new business development officer. Well, by definition, I'm a skilled and experienced negotiator. What I should do is offer to negotiate on behalf of my clients and prospective clients. Purchase of homes, property, business, automobiles, other expensive items for members of my network. Why not? I have much more experience than they do cutting big deals.
And to do this, even though it's not directly related to your core product or service, right?
Exactly, Mike. What's interesting about it, think about it. You're a marketer. Many of your clients are not. You could save them tens of thousands of dollars by doing this. And if you do do this, they will tell other people about you.
And I'm sure they'll be very grateful, too. Phase two, Tom, the revenue enhancer.
I think revenue enhancing is probably the single most important and powerful way to network with people. As I've often said, most affluent people have something to sell. And assume, again, I'm a sales professional. I often sell products and services on behalf of my clients, prospective clients, and other very influential network members. Yes, I sell more than my core service. The typical need, number one need of affluent people, is revenue enhancement, and I do that.
Phase three is called the loan broker.
Well, most of my clients tell me they hate to shop for loans. However, as a skilled negotiator, I enjoy the process. I especially like finding suitable credit sources for network members.
And again, you're doing this beyond the core product or service that you yourself offer. You're just doing this as an extra.
As an extra, and assuredly, do this for people, and they will tell other influential people about the wonderful fringe benefits of dealing with Tom Stanley or anybody else.
I tell you, Tom, I wish somebody would negotiate loans for me when it comes to that time, because it is an intimidating situation. Phase four, the talent scout.
Most successful business owners, as well as self-employed professionals, are constantly searching and screening new sources of supply. That's why I have developed a list of high-quality suppliers, suppliers of everything from office supplies to trucking services. This list is available to select members of my network. That's why many people seek me out, to gain this information.
You mean like if you have a client who happens to be in, say, the food processing business, you might have a network of suppliers that would provide the packaging, the distribution, the trucking, or whatever, that kind of thing?
Exactly. That's precisely why people seek me out. And in fact, in one instance that we'll mention later on, a young man who spent a lot of time marketing to people in the building and construction industry developed a wonderful Rolodex of over 400 people who were the top suppliers to that industry. Now, strangers call him and say, I wonder if you can make a recommendation. So not only does he act as a talent scout on behalf of prospects that call him, he acts as a revenue enhancer to the people he sends people to.
Many of these network experts employ not only one face, but two or three at the same time. They're doing a couple of different things at the same time.
Precisely.
Phase five is the publicist.
I'm more than a self-promoter. I often help my network members to gain visibility, recognition, and credibility, and they like me because of it.
Phase six, the mentor.
I often act as a mentor for clients who have various career and business-related problems. I teach them to fish, to succeed, to survive.
Phase seven, the advocate.
I often write unsolicited letters of support for the causes of clients, causes that are typically more important than any product or service that I or anyone else sells.
I know we're going to get into more detail about this a little bit later time, but I can't help but be curious here. Who are we writing letters to and why?
Well, in a situation where you're a supplier to any particular affluent business owner or professional, you must realize that you cannot sell them products unless they remain in business and they have money to pay for these things. So any threat, government threat, bureaucracy, whatever it may be, that threatens their livelihood ultimately threatens your livelihood.
And phase eight, the family advisor.
Many affluent families have problems that are not directly related to my core service. I often help them solve these problems. It's all part of my service. Most affluent people are family people with family problems.